Okay, we got a question pending. But before we get to it, I want to take things in a somewhat different direction now, because there's always confusion. So what I just said before break, what I didn't say. And for the moment, I'll just leave what I said with a bit more contextualization to stand on its own. For my purposes, it's fairly clear. It may not be necessarily completely clear for yours, but we'll see. What was it I did not say? Most important thing I did not say was that the only valid form of struggle and resistance is to pick up a gun. What I did not say is that if you're going to be legitimate in struggle, that you have to be a gun toter, a gun user, a bomb thrower, or anything related to that. See, I'm not a practitioner of American pacifism, so I do not impose a principle of purity on people who will participate in the struggle. My point is this. Those holding power in a social relation dictate ultimately the terms of the struggle. If you believe that you could formulate a petition and get a sufficient number of signatures to convince Adolf Hitler to be the opposite of a Nazi, then use petitions as your sole means of accomplishing change. If you believe that the Nazi government ultimately would have been responsible to the right rally, the march around the right square, a run across the right state or country, a bicycle ride, a candlelit prayer vigil using the right scent of candle or incense. If you believe that you could have voted the Nazis out of office, because after all, the Nazis were voted in to office, then pursue electoral politics. If you think you can adopt a different diet, a fashion style, clothing, attire, haircut, get the right tattoo, take the right pill, be sensitive enough, build a better bike path, or any of the rest of that, and accomplish change in the context of something that, in the face of what we're talking about, has to be considered not so much immoral as absolutely amoral structure of power. If you think you can form a moral argument that will convince an amoral entity to become something other than it is, then make the argument. If you think we can do it through talks like this or books like I and other people write, or offering better courses at the university or altering the preschool experience or any of the rest of that, go for it. Ultimately, I think you know as well as I do that none of that would have worked in Germany. And there's therefore every reason to know just as certainly that none of that or the combination of that is going to work here. You're not going to litigate it out of existence either. The courts of the country are not in a position, even if they were so inclined, to enter a decree that would require the government of the United States to do, oh, let's pick some possibilities. Withdraw from.
I thought you didn't want to talk at people.
Well, I'm going to finish saying what I'm saying. I just drove 1,500 miles to say it. And I said I'd say it, and it would take the pending question or comment, which appears to be what you're going to have to offer. Well, that's fine. Withdraw from the occupied territories of America or dissolve itself. You know it would be unenforceable. And you certainly are not going to be able to pass a new statute that's going to accomplish the necessary result. That said, most all of those things, perhaps short the pill and the tattoo and the particular scent on the candles, can be useful, can create space, can create sense of empowerment among people who feel disempowered. The object is not to create just sense of personal empowerment, is to create the dynamic of power, and you build that. You build that, however, with a particular consciousness. And the consciousness is this. I'll quote Mahatma Gandhi on it so that you don't think I'm copping his lines. You build it so that it's understood that there is a capacity to exercise force in kind and equivalence, which will allow more peaceful methods to work. In other words, as a relatively disempowered group agitating for social change, you foreclose no tactical option to confront power. And that is not to speak to power, it is to speak to people to understand that there will be a necessity of armed struggle because the state will impose it, is already imposing it. And while not everyone will participate directly in that, everyone of conscience and consciousness is obligated of necessity to support those who do, not to revile and condemn, isolate and neutralize them, doing the work of the state for it. With that said, you can now step up to the microphone and tell me everything I said was wrong.
I've been debating whether I want to be stupid enough to be the sacrificial lamb. I don't think any minds are going to be changed here tonight, and I don't think you're serious. I don't think you're interested in a real debate. I really don't. It's real easy to make cheap shots about, you know, fashion and petitioning, and it's not true. No one's suggesting that. There are people that are suggesting that, but you know, it's like those aren't the only two alternatives. Like, let's bomb the World Trade Center or let's petition. I mean, can we maybe like take this to a more reasonable? You know, because that's such a cheap shot. I mean, it's so easy.
I think I ran down about 25 different things there, so it wasn't bipolar.
You know, I've been sitting here and trying to be positive and not be critical and trying to be respectful and find the things I agree with you, because I agreed with some of the things that you said. But I've been getting increasingly frustrated because, I don't know, I've just been to too many of these talks, you know, where someone comes in and it's just like they give me their despair and their anger, and I'm sitting here feeling intimidated as a white person, like who am I to tell some Native American AIM activist that they're not supposed to be angry and despairing, but I get so frustrated because I don't think this is going to work. I really don't. I mean, I don't think people are going to leave here like inspired or with love in their heart or like doing anything positive. And as far as the bombing, I'm sorry, I don't mean to be self-righteous. You know, I'm not a pacifist. I'm willing to die for what I believe in. I've already risked my physical safety in the streets. But I think it's really cowardly for people in this room to laugh about the idea of killing people in the World Trade Center, because I don't think most of you could do it if you had to actually physically take a knife and do it. You know, I mean, that's the same thing the U.S. government does, is do things from the air, do things at a distance, and I think if most of us had to actually physically stab a stockbroker, let alone a janitor or a pizza worker in the World Trade Center on the food court, I don't think we could do it. I have a certain respect for people that could do it, actually, just because they're consistent. But I have worked for several luxury hotels as a banquet server, and I am part of the evil because I have served food to corporate clients. You know, I am no more innocent than the people in the World Trade Center that worked as janitors or that worked in the food court. So if they deserve to be bombed, I deserve to be bombed. And I know I don't deserve to be bombed. And I don't believe that if you and your wife were killed on a plane, that you truly believe what you said, that you would say, oh, that's fair because I'm not in. I don't believe you. I don't believe that you would think that was fair. I really don't. You know, if I do nothing else with the rest of my life but love myself and love those close to me, love my immediate family and friends, and try to survive, that will not be a wasted life, because I am as valuable as a child in Iraq. I'm not more valuable, but I'm not less valuable. I can more easily love people here than I can love people overseas. The most loving thing I can do is not support the war. As far as more active strategies, I don't know. I mean, I don't want to contribute to this evil, but unless the rest of you are willing to feed me, I'm going to be doing it for some time. So I don't personally feel comfortable supporting bombing people that some of them are not any better than me. And if you're honest, many of you work for the same kind of evil corporations that I've worked for. You know, so I'm almost done, but I'm probably going to be accused of being like defensive and missing the point and over personalizing this, but I do take this very seriously, because when you talk about war, you're talking about actual killing, and I understand the point that's being made, but it is going to come down to like people like me being killed because I live in the U.S., like my family being killed because we live in the U.S., and yeah, I take that seriously. So if anyone thinks that I'm worth killing because of the fact that I've worked for the Westin, you know, meet me face to face with a knife, and I'll respect you more than I respect people cynically laughing at something that happened a long ways away, that it's just too easy for us to do.
With the exception of, I don't remember anybody laughing, but maybe I missed something, it's going to be really hard to debate with you, because you didn't disagree with me at all. It's not emotion, and my wife and I will not be killed in an airplane. She was already killed, okay? And there's no way I'm going to prove a negative to you. You don't believe me, you don't believe me. Fine. But I say it right up front, and I wager I'm on aircraft a lot more than you. I know the point you're making. And my point was, if you don't like that, then do it yourself. My point was also, you don't personally have to pick up a gun. What you have to do is support those who do.
No, I don't. I don't. I can.
Fine. Then you are entitling yourself to a position of privilege and exemption, because unlike the Iraqi babies who don't have anything to say about it, they're just dying because they're Iraqis, period.
We all know that, and I didn't cause that. I mean, it's just pointless.
The Germans didn't cause it either, did they?
It's not the same thing at all.
Oh, it's all different. Fine, you're right. We can't debate. Those who harbored Jews died right along with those who didn't.
I'm willing to die, as I've said before.
Then we're on the same page.
No.
Well,
I won't sell you out to the government, but we're not on the same page. I can disagree with you without selling you out to the government.
Fine. I just said, we agree. That's your obligation. Don't sell me out to the government. That's support. Your fashion statement, you're entitled to, and it can accomplish something in distancing. You raised that, so I'm responding. It can accomplish something in distancing you from those with whom you would not want to be associated, ideologically, in practical terms, and so forth. It can be a statement of solidarity between people. I said many of the things I mentioned could be useful in their own right, in and of themselves, and in combination. Those things I listed would not accomplish the change. That is what I, in fact, said. You said absolutely nothing to disagree with that. Therefore, we have nothing to debate. You can be as resentful as you like. You're still in agreement. You understand what you're refusing, but you'll work through it.
Don't speak for me, thank you.
Why? You spoke for me.
No, I did not.
I don't believe you. I don't believe you. You assess the content and quality of my integrity.
No,
that was exactly what it was. Either I spoke the truth or I was lying. You don't believe me. I had to be lying. That goes to my integrity. You empowered yourself to do that, so do not protest when I explain what it was I heard you say.
Sir, I have not called you a liar. I disagree with some of the statements.
I do not believe you. Yes. Finally.
Yes, it is.
And finally, to the group, she's correct about my anger. With what I'm talking about and the experience that goes with it, yes, I am angry And my only question is, why aren't we? You? To love, you must fight. Then we agree.
I see the question as one is of effectuality. You use that word, what you get done, whether you do it with the candle, the protest, or the gun. The end result is what has to get done. And
that's
if you don't do it, you keep coming back, and keep coming back, and you keep coming back.
That's correct.
I don't know how many people here were upset when they first saw the 9/11 towers. I wasn't.
Thank you.
My second thought was, they're being real stupid about how they're handling it. Because if I was doing it, it would have been dirty. It wouldn't have been just an airplane into a tower. It would have been the dirty bomb. And then I started thinking about another American that did do something, and I asked you about it, and you seemed like you were really ready to talk about Timothy McVeigh, who we hear was this right-wing guy who hated all those other people, and gee, why did he do what he did? And I think maybe he was a stand-up guy in one way, and I think in another way he was ineffectual.
I couldn't disagree with the final assessment. In a vacuum, any action is ineffectual. There has always to be follow-up. There will not be transformation affected by event. We won't sell tickets. What was it Gil Scott Heron used to say? Revolution will not be televised, in part because it's a process. It takes a while. At the time he wrote those lines, you were at the culminating point of a somewhat mismanaged 12 to 14 year process, and that's to frame it very narrowly, that began with a heavy and sinister action of a black woman who was not a random passerby but a trained cadre sitting on the front of a Southern bus. And that takes you to the Black Liberation Army, and there's a direct line of continuity between the two. My own practice is this. I believe in armed struggle. I have participated in armed struggle, and fully 90% of all my, well, I'll run it up from there to be more accurate, 95% plus of all the political activity I have engaged in the last 35 years of continuous political activity has been nonviolent. This is not a call, as I said, to the purity of the gun. There is no purity in the gun any more than there is a purity in what passes for pacifism here in this country. And it's to your credit that you will take the risk. A pacifist would. See, that is pacifism. You won't hurt others. It doesn't mean a thing about exempting yourself from risk. You incur risk. That's the key. But the ultimate aspect of this is not to demonstrate personal purity. That's an ego trip. The object is to win. And that takes consistency, and it takes time. And it's not going to be an immediacy of the kind of action that ultimately has to occur to affect transformation. That is a building process, but it is the consciousness that you carry into it, which is key. What are you building towards? You know that, or you can deny it. And the history of activity, which has led to the ineffectuality of the American opposition movement in all its permutations over the last 100 years, by and large, has been denial. The displacement of the reality on those in the receiving end, elsewhere, everywhere, anywhere but here. And that is not love. Anybody else?
Thanks.
Oh, but I never got to McVeigh. McVeigh. I got to the ineffectuality part of it. What was McVeigh about so far as we know? He came back disenchanted with what it was his government had sent him to do to other people in the Gulf, which doesn't sound, if he was a right-winger, like a racist right-winger. And that was tangible, and it's all through his writing. But what was the catalyst for Timothy McVeigh? Something called Waco, where the government of the United States, well, there's a lot of stuff that I could talk about with regard to Waco, but I won't go into it now unless somebody wants to. But you need to pay attention to these so-called right-wing wackos, too, because they, too, are human beings. and what gets done to them can get done to you. There's lessons to be learned from that. The government of the United States corrected a situation of alleged child abuse by burning the children alive. That's the situation. And that upset him just a little bit. Now, that would be an inhuman response. And he couldn't manage, somehow or another, to get much resonance from the idea that there had been an atrocity of the first degree committed not just in the Persian Gulf, in which he had participated, but in Texas, which he had witnessed. The response level of the American public, other than hand-wringing and endorsing investigations exonerating the perpetrators, was just about zilch, as you'll recall. I don't remember any mass protests of the burning of those children alive. And so, you could call it an act of desperation, if you will, an act of confusion, if you will, an act of ineffectuality. He took it back to the people who had dispensed it so nearly as he could figure out how to do it. And he detonated a large truck bomb, that's the story, in front of a building, and he killed kids in the building. He didn't kill FBI or BATF agents because they weren't there. He killed a bunch of people. Okay? And he was queried about children. He said very much the same thing I said about Trade Center. I care about them just the way you ought to have cared about the kids in Waco. But nobody seemed to care all that much about them. All right, what goes around comes around, as the WAG once put it. But now, let's cover a couple of other things and we'll get into whatever you want to get into. Anybody been around a 1,500 pound bomb that's detonated? You ever directly seen the results of that? Okay, let's say you place it flat on pavement. What happens to the pavement? Yeah. Okay, the literature's available at this point. The little voyeuristic frenzy's over, so it'll be in used bookstores very cheap. Go get yourself some Waco literature photo books, okay? Look at the front of the building from the aerial photographs and show me the crater. Show you the double shear lines in the roof. See, they trained me to do this stuff so I can talk about it in that sense, but I'm in consonant with the chief ballistics officer of the U.S. Air Force on this. You understand that when you put a freestanding explosive device, unless it's a shaped charge, out and detonate it in the open, it puts out a concentric blast. In other words, it blows out in a circle. So when it hits a solid plane of a building, it's going to cut a half moon shape in. You look at the roof line on the aerial photographs of the Oklahoma City building, you see a double half moon starting to form. The fact of the matter is, a 1,500-pound nitrogen fertilizer bomb placed where they said it was placed, the exterior of the building could not have caused the damage to that building that was caused. I'm going no further with that than that. Do I know what happened? Hell no, I don't know what happened. What I do know is what they said happened didn't happen the way they said it happened. Okay? One piece. I'll just let that perk you take it where you want to go. That's a lot closer to your Reichstag fire, I think. But it also adds some credibility to your contention. I mean, you can take it from Tommy the Traveler, Tongi Eye, up in the Northeast pretending to be an SDS or burning ROTC buildings in order to instigate stuff in the late 1960s, early 1970s to Oklahoma City. And potentially there's a line that would take you to the World Trade Center, but I will not disempower brown people until I know that to be true. All right? That being done, they would certainly use it. Next piece, and I'll just leave this one to be thought about a little bit too, because we were talking a little earlier about racial profiling, and by virtue of being Arab, you would be profiled as a potential terrorist because there were Arabs on the aircraft, or at least that's what people believe to be true, because that's what we've been told. Actually, by both sides, so it probably is true. When Oklahoma City happened, it was generally believed it was probably a Mideast terrorist who did it. Rush Limbaugh came on the radio, and I actually think I still have the tape of this. In any event, the tapes would be retrievable, so this can be checked out. Rush Limbaugh went on the radio, and he's got a fair listenership, and he said we should bomb Baghdad immediately. And somebody said, well, why Baghdad? There's no indication, no concrete link of anybody from Iraq to Oklahoma City. He said, because somebody from over there did it. And by God, those people in Baghdad said, did so much to create the climate in which this happened that we ought to bomb them anyway. And then it turns out, you know, the people are listening to this and random Arabs are getting grabbed off street corners for about a week in there and just beaten to a pulp by virtue of being Arab, because after all, that's how you respond when those wogs bomb your buildings. And it turns out to be this Gulf War vet, crew cut, blonde hair, blue-eyed Timothy McVeigh guy from Detroit. Anybody remember those roving bands of fraternity boys grabbing random white guys off street corners and beating them into a puddle? Because after all, it was a white guy who did it. Forget about Michigan. Following the logic, Limbaugh would have had to have been on the radio that very night demanding an airstrike be called in on himself, since he had so much to do with instigating the bombing in Oklahoma City. Yeah. McVeigh, whatever McVeigh actually was, aside from suffering some very human trauma as a result of the experience and the betrayal that he felt by being placed in essentially a Hitlerian army for a period of time, when it's not what he expected to do, it's not what he thought he was going to do, and I don't know when we're going to be able to develop a way to communicate one generation to the next that it ain't about Audie Murphy on the screen. It may have been about Audie Murphy in the Second World War, but Audie didn't talk about that all that much because he had the worst case of PTSD and probably anybody in World War II. They didn't talk about that, the great hero. All right. Timothy McVeigh was an example of carnage. His own, psychologically, as a result of very tangible experiences that are integral to the functioning of this system. And that carnage produced other carnage, or so it appears, but it did not produce it in the way that you've been led to believe that it produced it. He did not act alone, and he didn't act just with Terry Nichols. And he may have been, like Lee Harvey Oswald put it, the patsy of the whole thing, but he was proud of it. He was proud that he had actually stood up, or people believed that he had actually stood up and responded in kind to that atrocity that had occurred in Waco and those atrocities that he knew to have occurred in the Gulf. That he, very uniquely, either had done something or people believed he did, and he wanted to carry that with him. So, is that enough on McVeigh?
Thanks again for coming.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask a question about effectiveness. It seemed to me that the 911 attacks were particularly ineffective in that they haven't been incorporated into a clear, publicly known strategy, and thus they fail as solidarity building exercises, and they tend to relegate everyone else to the role of spectators. As far as the Oklahoma City attacks, as you yourself point out, that may have been intended to play right into the hands of the government.
What I actually said was it might have been the government.
Right. Leon Trotsky wrote years ago against individual terrorism, which I just like to recommend to everyone here, arguing that it's an ineffective tactic. And I'd just like to hear your reply.
See if I can remember. I think you had 3 points in there. I'll try to get them all. Well, hell, I'd agree with Trotsky on that, and that's a marvel. Okay? I don't know that I've advocated individual terrorism at all, and certainly 911 was not individual. That was an organizational event. It hasn't generated solidarity and follow-up. That's your fault. Why are you blaming them? They gave you the key. And that's a history of things, too. Refuse. And then blame the guy you just refused for the refusal. No, you own that one yourself. They did what they set out to do. And so far as I know, and I certainly am not privy to the inner thinking of Al-Qaeda, okay, but so far as I know, I have no evidence to the contrary, that figured very much into a strategy, which is their strategy, not my strategy, and that they're following through as they intend to. The question is, what's happening here? And the answer is, not much. But that's not their responsibility. It's yours. It's mine. It's ours. Okay? That's my response to that. Was there another point that I'm missing here? Okay, I thought you had three, but all right.
I just wanted to see if you could clear up a point of a note of history. Did the Iroquois Seven Nation have anything to do with the writing of the Constitution? Were they consulted? I just wanted to find out once and for all if this is true or not.
Well, first of all, Six Nations.
Okay.
Five add one with the Tuscarora coming north from North Carolina. You got the Haudenosaunee. That's a Six Nation Confederation. Okay. It's in the margin notes on the constitutional drafts of John Adams. It's in the annotations of Benjamin Franklin. Several others that I can't name, but Adams for sure, and it's probably most extensive there. The answer is, yeah, they were borrowing. Let's be polite. Okay. The structure and a bit of the conceptualization that underlay the structure of the Haudenosaunee in framing the U.S. Constitution, and the nature of the Confederation of States, the United States, okay? But they did it in a very distorted and diluted form, all right? There's nothing in there distinguishing between sexes in terms of franchise and Haudenosaunee practice, all right? The women were the political decision makers. Men were charged with executive functions, okay? The women actually made the decisions. In the United States version of things, women had nothing to say about nothing until well into the 20th century, for example. Okay, there was nothing about partial human beings either. And there's two interpretations, one in my view correct, the other not, with the idea of an African person brought to this hemisphere and held as a slave being three-fifths of a human being. I don't think that's what it actually said. I think what they had in mind from the way the thing is worded is that slaveholders would benefit by an increase of three-fifths of a vote for every slave held. All right? And African-Americans weren't considered to be vested with rights or humanity at all in the Constitution. There's nothing in the Iroquois tradition that would lead in that direction.
Oh, thanks for clearing that one up.
Okay. So, we got any place else to go? Okay.
You're talking earlier about how the state dictates what we can do. And with the amendments, the Constitution always being changed, I think it's hard for us to keep abreast. You know, I like to read, but I know there's a lot of people out there in the world that don't read. That's not part of the lifestyle. And, you know, I think we're a very fortunate few that actually do come participate to these events, that we do try to educate ourselves. I think, I don't know if I'm wrong, but the 60% of the population probably doesn't give a crap about what is written down by the government. And I think with this new Patriot Act, I don't understand why people are more against it. It's kind of strange. I've heard of incidences where whole families were destroyed in this area up in Everett. Families taken away, the businesses taken away, being held in INS detention for like 9 months for no apparent reason. And if the state is dictating what we can do and can't do, then that'd be a great place to start to do some activism. And, you know, if they don't want anything to be secret, then we should tell them this is what we're going to do. Exactly. You know, why keep things secret? If things are secret, then they have that chance to take you away. But if it's open and other people know about it, then how can they take you away without there being protests? I'd like to know, what do you think about the Patriot Act and what we can do and where we can go with it and get rid of it?
You just opened up another whole minefield here. I'll tell you how they can come and take you away without there being any protest, okay? But you'd be better off speaking to a Japanese-American, Isai or Nisai, about 75 years of age. Because they took them all, and they put them in camps, and there wasn't any protest. And all they did, those people, was be Japanese. All right? That's just an extravagant example. You can run it back to the earliest days of the Republic, people being rounded up for thinking wrong thoughts and saying wrong things, not committing tangible acts and getting locked up for it. You can look at other whole peoples. They interned the entirety of the Santee survivors of what they called Little Crow's War in southwestern Minnesota in 1863 after hanging them, 38 of the leadership in a mass hanging, the largest in U.S. history. There wasn't any protest about that. They were just Indians, though. These were just Japanese. They took the totality of the Navajo Nation, the Diné, force-marched them from Fort Defiance to the Bosque Redondo and turned them there for 4 years, living in holes in the ground. 50% of them died. There wasn't any protest. So they can do those sorts of things, which are regularly done through the course of U.S. history. If they can authorize themselves without protest under the McCarran Act to take what they call a key agitators index involving almost 100,000 American political people, that is people of political consciousness, consciousness that was objectionable to the status quo, and use those camps that they'd interned the Japanese Americans in to house the politicals and to keep that on the books from roughly 1950 to 1972, repeal it simply as a PR gesture because they figured out that they weren't going to get a concerted enough resistance at that time that they couldn't quell by other means, so they didn't need it anymore. So while they're battering movements to pieces, they're making this grandiose gesture of rescinding their self-empowerment to place their opposition in concentration camps. If they can do that, what makes you think, if you're actually having any tangible effect on the functioning of a power, they wouldn't do that to you? The only reason they wouldn't take you away is because you're not bothering them in the least. You see, that's not a superior morality, that's not benevolence, that's not a greater degree of enlightenment than those demon states they talk about out there, none of which have the proportion of the population locked up that this country does. Okay? It's because there's no particular reason to do it. Anything they're going to tell you you got a permit to do is of no consequence to them at all, or they would not issue you a permit. Oh yeah, they might take you down for your 3 hours booking before they, you know, to get you off the street for crowd control purposes before they cut you loose to go back or whatever, all right, and ultimately drop charges on most people. But they're not going to get serious and really take you away. So the only thing that can be considered consequential in terms of affecting the relations of power, the functioning of power in this country, is that which they do not approve. Now you can build through approved means if you inculcate consciousness in that process to the end result. You can go out and do the approved activities. You can do the marches. You can do the rallies. You can do boycotts. You can do pickets. You can do all of these things, and you can accomplish narrow results with them. You can empower people, and you can educate people to understand that the next step is we got to step off that cliff of approval. We got to do the stuff they don't approve of. And we got to continue to ramp it up to where we get to the point where this is an unmanageable situation. Then it can actually be changed. See, you got a situation here where on a planetary basis, it's about like the Indian Wars and that disparity of firepower. I said that at the beginning. The only way just an absolute concerted campaign of the kind of stuff that happened on September 11th. And I'll agree with you right here. I would just as soon not see that. The only alternative to that in the end is that we create the conditions of unmanageability through any and all available means to allow a restoration of some parity of what they like to call force projection out there so that other countries can begin to get this one in line. We don't ultimately need to bring it all down. It would be nice if we could. Okay, but what we have to do is diminish its capacity to project power in the fashion that it does now so that it cannot do in the world what it does now. That is an obligation. That is an obligation. So there's this continuum. There's a tactical continuum. There's a chronological continuum. But there needs to be a strategic vision of what it is that has to be done. And ultimately, what has to be done is the end result is this entity, which is here, isn't here when it's over. Okay, there's still going to be land, there's still going to be people, there's still going to be all of those components, but the state, the political, economic, military entity which constitutes the United States as it understands itself and as the world receives it, will not be there. And personally, I am not a revolutionary. I do not wish to overthrow the government of the United States so that myself or some select cadre of right-thinking people can assume the reins of power and rearrange it somehow. No, I really mean it won't be here. Okay? That it will be dismantled, indigenous sovereignty in each indigenous territory as recognized by treaty in the process of consolidation and creation. Creation and consolidation would be the right order of that. Of the United States would be a self-determining entity in its own right. That takes 400 chunks of territoriality out of the 48 contiguous states of the United States right there. And there are several other groups, most notably persons of Mexican descent covered under the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo down in the southwest, the internal colony of African Americans, those who identify with a national rights status are entitled to exercise it, Appalachian whites for that matter. When you're done with that, the territorial corpus, the geopolitical corpus of the United States does not exist. Is that unrealistic and unachievable? I don't know. Ask Leonid Brezhnev. Okay? I will say this. If you let your oppressor define what's realistic, reality for you is going to be oppressed. Yeah? So to be realistic in the sense we're talking about here, you have to demand the impossible. If you demand anything less, well, you always get less than you aspire to, so you see where that leaves you.
Short question. How does ecology play into your praxis?
How does ecology? Well, now, are we talking social ecology, deep ecology, which... Okay. Yeah, I'm going to try to lay it out this way in terms of thesis and antithesis. Thesis is neatly written down. Any of you who have never encountered this, take up a collection, go to a motel tonight, open the bedside drawer there and pull out the Bible. Okay, you're going to have it right there. You don't have to go into deep scriptural readings and become a Bible student or anything. Just go to page one. First page of Genesis has this thing about man being created in the image of God. Anybody ever heard that one? Okay, well, there's a few connotations of that. If man's created in the image of God, then God must be the image of man. I mean, placed both ways as being mirror images, right? So that's where you get this funny old guy with a white beard or whatever as being an image of the deity, all right? But it's sort of an implication that man will be God in a secular realm on earth. To be that, you're kind of apart from nature because in a figurative sense, you're the creator of it. You can't really signify that until you get a couple passages on down. But you're now not only standing apart from, but in a position above nature. So you're separate, alienated from nature. That's the view. Okay? And as a manifestation of godliness, well, you are to exercise dominion over the natural world. Dominance, in other words, you dominate nature. And you demonstrate the dominance by virtue of transforming it. Okay, taking nature as encountered and what's the word they like to use these days? Develop it into something else. Okay, So you destroy nature to create something to signify the fact that you have acted on nature. You didn't create nature itself. The real God did that, but you transform it and thus demonstrate godliness, and on that basis are enjoined in the exercise not only of that right, but that obligation to multiply, grow plentiful, and populate the earth, which can only be done if you're displacing other species. So this is about as anti-natural a view as it's possible for me to articulate on the basis of conception. Maybe some of you can take it a little further, but that's quite far enough for me. So there's thesis. Antithesis, I can't speak for all Native people. I don't even know about all Native people. But I have personal interaction with a fair number of them, and my knowledge of them, which is not the same as speaking for them, but I'm not sure that any of them would really want to contradict this, because it seems consonant with the beliefs that I've observed or experienced, see themselves, my people certainly do, and I'll start there, see ourselves as being integral to, part of, within nature, not separate apart, much less above, but functioning within, with particular characteristics that define us as who we are as relatives among other relations, okay, including this thing, which you can view as the blessing or, more commonly, the curse of rationality, okay, and that it's a curse because it gives you the capacity to destroy that upon which you depend for existence. So rather than transforming nature, what we have is a system that enjoins us, both empowers and enjoins, or empowers and constrains. The empowerment is you can do anything you want. It's relatively rule-free, other than act in the world in such a way as to make it fundamentally different than it was when you encountered it, because it's your obligation to pass it along to your children in the same condition of survivability as your parents passed along to you. In fact, you need to look at it not just in terms of, will this sustain my children if I do this, but will it sustain their children and their children's children and seven generations into the future? And you got that framing, as opposed to James Watts, for example, who claimed that we needed to fill what was left of the redwoods because, after all, doomsday would be here in 3.5 weeks, and, you know, it'd be a waste of natural resources not to have consumed them before that happened. You've got this very narrow, short-term, continuous, artificial lung approach to it. No matter what damage we can do through scientific rationality to the planet, we can always rely on a religious-like sort of way for science to find a solution to it that'll perpetuate the process. Ultimately, the contradiction between science and religion that the West espouses disappears right there, because only a religion can have faith in the result that is not known before the fact. That's antithetical to scientific tradition. So you got a scientific, religious fervor that's occurring on the one hand, which is devoted to perpetual consumption. On the other hand, you have a worldview and a practice that is devoted to retaining the balance and the harmony of the natural world as it is encountered by you who are integral to it. Okay, that's about as far as I can take it. But all right, social relations work somewhat the same way. So that takes care of social and the other ecology.
I was wondering how, since so much of political action today takes place in a sort of defensive mindset, that we're like defending attacks on our civil rights or ecological things and just everything like that, how you sort of see activists making a transition from like defensive maneuvers to like an offensive, where we're actually like going for the kind of things that you were talking about.
Well, you got another continuum. You can actually call it a hierarchy, okay? I know we're all opposed to the hierarchy. Actually, we're opposed to a particular hierarchy. Hierarchy exists in nature. So opposing the hierarchy is, in that sense, kind of like opposing the moon, okay? And I am, you know, adamantly opposed to the moon. I'm going to have the moon abolished now. Hierarchy is kind of like having priorities, you know? There's greater ones and there's lesser ones, and that's hierarchy. So we deal with hierarchy to oppose a particular hierarchy, okay? We have greater issues and we have lesser issues, and the greater issues present themselves, and we can address them only by virtue of having addressed at least some portion of the lesser issues.
Yeah.
Okay? That's the process of developing solidarity and cohesion, a sense of empowerment and ability to challenge and yeah. so on.
I'm with you. I'm
okay.
with you there.
So let's pick a few from Seattle.
Yeah.
All right?
What's that?
Let's pick a few from Seattle that are the lower continuum but an integral part of everyday life that are... Okay. Well, let me get to it this way. I'm going to impersonate W for a moment. And I want to talk about freedom. I want to talk about freedom. And I know that we can get all philosophical in our discussion of freedom, but I'm kind of a Texas country boy. So I want to break it down so that everybody's going to understand what it means in social sense, because we're all for it. See, freedom is not absolute because we're human beings. You're never going to, you can aspire to it, you always should, but you're never going to achieve it. It's going to be a relative thing. So freedom as we encounter it socially is a relative absence of regulation. Okay, the converse is more regulation. And by that perfectly comprehensible definition, pound for pound and line for line, you are the least free people on the planet ever in history. If you look at the regulatory structure that's been imposed upon you, so much so that, like colonization for Europeans, it's just numb and anesthetic, never even think about it. So start right there and liberate things that are absolutely irrationally imposed as a regulatory reality for purposes of regimenting you, and more importantly, regimenting your consciousness, yeah? Mm-hmm. That people can actually respond to with an investiture of maybe 3 seconds thought. Maybe we'll generate applause from, oh, I don't know, maybe even a banker and a soccer mom along the way, because I'm sure they don't like sitting on the, what do they call it, 20-minute weave? You know about the 20-minute weave? You ever take a bus? You ever wait for that bus? When you're waiting for the bus, do you ever sit down and what they provide you is seating to wait? Is it a bench where you can sit there and talk to somebody? You have facing benches, maybe where you can have face-to-face conversations while you're waiting for that gigantic empty bus that just went by? Belching diesel fumes into this pristine environment?
No, I don't think there's much seating in most bus stops, but the ones that are.
They have, as I understand it, maybe not completed the process of replacement in all bus stops, but they've replaced them with seats that face away from one another so people cannot engage in conversation. That's to discourage you from using them for anything other than sitting and waiting for the bus. That's the approved purpose, okay? And you shouldn't be conversing with people anyway, because that's potentially subversive activity. And you don't have a solid seat or a padded seat or any kind of reasonable seat. What you got is a seat that's made out of a metal mesh called a 20-minute weave. Why is it called a 20-minute weave? Because after 20 minutes, your ass is going to be so numb, you're going to get up and you're going to move around. That's your public service. Okay? Now, how about you just make some nice cushioned things that are contoured to fit right down on top of that and start. Okay?
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
Why don't you just start right there? I bet you can get participants from among people who never thought they were political in their life, but you are challenging a regulation. Ultimately, you repeal it in practice, but you can begin to develop a consciousness that people can demand a repeal to this bullshit expenditure of their money to prevent them from using what they bought. Okay. What's the definition of loitering in this town? Indians get hit on this all the time.
Yeah,
not buying. He got it immediately. No, actually he got it. Not buying things.
That's vagrancy.
Vagrancy, sorry. Loitering, you probably had it. Let's take them both. Okay, loiter in the jack-in-the-box. Okay, no, I don't mean personally go down and loiter in a jack-in-the-box. I mean the whole damn room go loiter in a jack-in-the-box. Have systematic loiterings. Really? Really?
I'm looking at the menu.
Where'd our attorney go? I don't know the statutes in the city. Okay. In Colorado, and I assume this is the case, or there's going to be a variation of it in Washington State as well. Okay? You are, as a citizen, entitled, and this is a formal entitlement. That doesn't mean it's a practical entitlement, but you can enter a motion in a court. If you have gone to the district attorney pointing to a violation of the statutory code and got no response, you can go get the court to enter a decree ordering the DA to take action, bring prosecution. So go in to one, pick yourself a well-used yuppie store and go in and monitor the clientele. And the first person that goes out of there without buying something, demand that they be arrested for loitering. Okay? Because the definition of loitering is not purchasing. So in order to enter a store, you are compelled by law to buy. You otherwise cannot exit. That's your rule as you set it up. Okay? And if the cop won't make the arrest, which they won't, take it to the DA, who won't order the cops to make an arrest in that case, and you can take it to court. And meanwhile, play media. Start running their own contradictions in their face. But there is a resonance that can be achieved psychologically with people who are not political activists, because they too are bothered by the insanity of this stuff. Varying degrees. Most soccer moms are not likely to be arrested for loitering unless you bring action to place her in a way where she can be consonant with what it actually means. That's why I say pick a yuppie department store. Okay. There's three. Local environment, and I'm not even from here. You look like a bright, intelligent, imaginative group of people. Get to it. But pick things that are going to appeal outside the frame of your political consciousness. Otherwise, you end up talking to yourselves. Pick things which may seem trivial, but are going to resonate with people who, if nothing else, are driven into the chronic desperation of American life by being regimented into oblivion. And they know that. But give them some ability to mount a coherent response, even if it seems trivial. That can create a sense of consciousness and empowerment that leads to the next step, see. Kwame Ture, Stokely Carmichael, once told me that he had been arrested 38 times and done a year in parchment prison, organizing people to exercise the franchise in the South. And he had never cast a vote, didn't believe voting would do anything constructive at all in terms of impact upon the system. What he did believe, however, is that the people he was organizing to exercise its franchise had been told they could not, and had for a certain period of time accepted the fact that they could not. And in convincing them that they could, and following through and casting that otherwise meaningless vote, he empowered them. No. Actually, let me retract. Kwame would not have put it that way. He convinced them to take the step to empower themselves. And on that basis, they could begin to take the other incremental steps that led to the exercise of genuine power. That's what that book, Black Power, was about, that big scary thing. And the reason it was scary, I mean, all it was about was voting, which was terrifying because the logic of where it could lead was way beyond voting. And that was what was important. See, the status quo understood that much better than most of the radical community. That the issue wasn't voting itself. The issue was not taking no for an answer.
A lot of the notes you're giving us are on active resistance. And one of the most active resistances I can think of right now that's somewhat successful is the Zapatistas in Mexico. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on how their ongoing struggle is going and where they can take it, or what we can learn or borrow.
What we can learn, perhaps, from that particular example is the ongoing tenacity and insistence upon survival and retention of traditional ways of indigenous peoples, and that ramifications of that are hemispheric, okay? The ability of what did Fanon call it, wretched of the earth? I mean, these people are living on $40 a year. They're not exactly affluent. They don't have access to technology and a whole lot of other things that they can take the technology of the state and defeat it initially. Okay? But the next piece is what gets kind of garbled here. Now they got turned into cult heroes, and there's posters of the Zapatistas, and there's networking about the Zapatistas, and there's newsletters about the Zapatistas. There's radio programs, there's motion pictures, there's solidarity statements, there's everything except a tangible follow-up, and see, they can't do it in isolation. Right?
Very much.
there's a matter of scale that's involved here. Again, they took the step, they took the risk, they paid the price, they showed the way, and everybody sat there and said, wow, good for you. And that was it. Well, again, I could be called too simplistic on that, and it is a bit too simplistic, but there was not a follow-up in kind. They considered in Guerrero, and they stood down, okay, but more importantly, effusive embrace in terms of solidarity from up here, but no tangible actions this side of the border, some in Canada. Mm-hmm.
And all groups I hear are mobilizing.
Cycle one, cycle
and
two, we're going into third cycle.
Cancun in September.
Yeah.
It just happens to be that their statement is a month or two ahead.
Yeah. And I am by no means saying not to confront the WTO, although don't confront the WTO in the same way it's been done before. Never become predictable. Never let them. Yeah. Okay. But WTO is the extent that that's the side of the action dictating the terms again, including what terrain the action is going to occur on. The seat of the problem is not in the WTO per se. The seat of the problem is here where we're sitting. Here's where the action needs to occur. The consequential action will occur here, independent of where they're holding the WTO. That said, confront on. See? So we keep picking these symbolic targets. Now that target is symbolic in a way that's more crucial than a lot of other possible symbolic targets. But the functioning of power really isn't contingent on the meeting hall and the location of the meeting hall of the WTO. See? Statement gets made, and empowerment can occur, and so it's important. But we need to get beyond that as well. Not discontinue it, move beyond it. Use it as the basis to move to the next level.
All right, my question is that you've written pretty extensively about counterintelligence programs of the FBI and the all sorts of other security agencies, and I was wondering what sort of, maybe to talked about a lot of things, but I haven't talked about that very much tonight, and so maybe also what is new, especially with the Patriot Act, and then secondly, what are strategies that people who consider themselves part of some sort of resistance can take to not fall into the traps that have been set?
Well, this actually doubles back to some stuff that was said earlier with regard to the Patriot Act. But guess what? Patriot Act is not unimportant. It is, however, not key. The key went right by without anybody outside of a very narrow spectrum of people who pay attention to these things and were yelling, but nobody was paying attention at the time. Happened in 1996 with something called the Counterterrorism or Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996. Okay? And here's a short version of that. Everything they were doing that was illegal in COINTELPRO got rendered legal right there. And the Patriot Act is an additive list, refinements to that. Not so much in terms of curtailment of liberty, although it does that as a creation of licensure for operations that would otherwise have been considered illegal within the confines of the United States when directed at least at U.S. citizens. All that's a license now. But a mention was made of changing the Constitution. They didn't change the Constitution to do any of this. The Constitution hasn't been amended. What they did was just void the Constitution. You can forget about the Constitution, but that's not something that happened with the Patriot Act. Another little piece of the Patriot Act, which is about that thick, that's one reason it wasn't read by the majority of Congress people who signed it, although had they read it, they would have signed it anyway. So that's one of those kind of, okay, it's an interesting point, but it's not particularly relevant. The point is, that came out within a month of 9/11. They didn't draft that thing in the month between 9/11 and its passage. That was already drafted. And that sort of goes to his notion of it being a pretext. But they did managed to put the 96 Act on the table and get it passed without having something as catastrophic as 911. So there's no indication that that's not a coincidental thing. They were going forward with it anyway. All right? So here's the deal. Constitution still exists. You can check it out of the library. You can go to Washington, D.C. and see one of the original copies. You can read the thing. It's there in black and white. It enunciates your formal rights. You, as Americans, have all those rights. Those rights secure your freedom. All right? And you are invested with those rights up to, absolutely up to, the moment you attempt to exercise one, at which point you will be targeted for neutralization. Okay? Translated, that means you are indeed free. This is a people free to do exactly what it's told in every aspect of his existence, every facet of day-to-day life. I poll my classes, I could poll you as well. Name me one thing you do in your daily life that is not subject to a regulation telling you, A, you can't do it. B, you have to do it. And C, since you're doing it, here's how.
You don't have to work.
Oh. Being unemployed is a hell of a lot of work in this society.
Yes.
Usually, the students, and I'm talking graduating senior honor students in philosophy, are reduced in very short order to babbling about bodily functions. Guess what? They're regulated as well. Yeah. I'm going to brush my teeth. Not with a unapproved, governmentally approved toothbrush, toothpaste. Where are you getting the water? On and on. It's all subject to regulation. Okay? So you're free to do absolutely what you're told, whether you know it or not, in virtually or literally every single thing you do in your waking life, and quite a lot of what you do while you're asleep as well. Yeah. Where you sleep is most definitely regulated. Try going out and sleeping in that doorway or a city park. I mean, the park belongs to the people. Try using it. Okay, well, let me add a piece to that since I'm being all suggestive.
Okay?
And it's just up for consideration. And as I say, there's different aptitudes and inclinations, and these can all fit together as long as there's a consciousness of how they have to fit together. All right? Back in 1966, a couple college students, Merritt College in Oakland, California, created something called the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense. The law as it existed at the time in California, which was understood quite well by Huey P. Newton, who was a pre-law student, okay, said that you could carry an unconcealed shotgun, loaded, locked down, with the same firepower that the police were carrying at the time. They hadn't graduated to Heckler and Koch assault rifles and such as that, okay, shotgun to shotgun. Panthers went out and patrolled the police who were abusing the black community of Oakland mercilessly. I can't remember the data off the top of my head, but it was impressive. Bogus arrests. I mean, they were beating people up, taking them in, holding 72 hours, no intent to prosecute, cutting them loose, regular basis, curbside justice, doors kicked in, all manner of stuff. Panthers started street patrols, shotgun in one hand, law book in the other. Cop wanted to get confrontational and jack around into the chamber and read him the relevant passage of law he was violating. Okay? Can't do that anymore. That's a case where they did change the Constitution in response to Black Panthers exercising their constitutional right to police the police. They weren't interfering with the police. They were just making sure they weren't messed with while they monitored the police so they could witness and make book on abuses by the police, which curtailed the abuses by the police. That I can't remember. Starts at X, ends up at Y. Y is 50% lower in 9 months than X. Okay? That act caused that result. Well, you can't do that in California. They changed the Constitution to prevent the carrying of the shotguns, and the law book is incidental to a cop. The shotgun's what counts. Okay? They understand the mechanics of their position. But you can do something else, as the Rodney King case demonstrated. You just don't want to do it with quite the style of the Panthers. And that was real important style at the time. It was an empowering style to a very disempowered group of people that had been abused by the police systematically and abused by the economic system, abused by everything else systematically in the Oakland inner city for over 30 years at that point. And just the fact of a black guy standing up and jacking around in a shotgun and backing a cop down had incredible morale effect for that community. You can't do that, and you probably don't need to do that in Seattle at the present time. What you can do instead of a shotgun, you need to get conversant with the law, okay, and take yourself a video camera and mount street patrols, okay, so that the odds of a Rodney King situation next time they want to beat somebody to a pulp goes up dramatically, and they can't say, he hit me first, he was drunk, he was aggressive, he resisted arrest, he did this, when they got him on the ground, beating him with the clubs. All right? That's something you can do. And that changes the dynamics of power. It does. Starts backing the police off, but it also brings people in a position of believing they can stand on their rights and not just get beaten into a puddle for it with impunity by the police. And the point of all of this continuum is to remove the pretense of impunity and entitlement to impunity on the part of the perpetrators. Okay? Thank you all.